was talking with my mom recently about our ancestors, trying to get a better understanding of my family roots. My mother's side of the family are Irish farmers. Her maiden name was Spring, a nice, good Irish name. But her mother's family were Morelands. That's deep Irish and Welsh background. And their parents were Ogdens. She told me a story about my great-great-grandfather, who was an Ogden. He was a farmer in southern Iowa, out in a rural community. And he happened to be the pastor of the local Church of the Brethren church. The church was so small that they could not pay him to be the minister, so he farmed full-time to support his family and preached on Sundays. When his third child, who happened to be my great-grandmother, my great-grandmother Moreland, was born, his wife died in childbirth. A widower, he was now tasked with raising three small children, farming full-time, and preaching on Sundays. After about a year of this, the elders of the church came to speak to him. They said, "Reverend Ogden, you need a wife. And since you are so busy farming and preaching and raising your three kids, we will go find one for you." The elders left and went north, northern Iowa, up near the Minnesota border. Somewhere up there, they found a woman willing to come back with them. They came back with a woman who agreed to marry Reverend Ogden. Together, they had seven more children. I tell you this story because I have to be honest. I think our elders need to pick up their game a little bit. I'm just saying, this church couldn't pay their pastor, but the elders went out and found him a wife. I mean, that's dedication. That is commitment. I mentioned to Bob Pape this morning and John Beaver, I'll tell you as well, head of the elders. I just think the elders need to bring their A game. I'm just saying. Now, what my wife will think about that, I could not tell you. But I like learning about ancestors, hearing those types of stories about family, hearing of where we came from, what makes us us. Often when I was growing up, if I got mad or frustrated or was losing my cool, my mother would tell me that I was letting my Moreland show. Because my grandmother Moreland, my great-grandmother Moreland, had a notorious temper. She was hot-headed and stubborn. And my mother delighted in comparing me to this woman I could barely remember from my youngest years. But we see traits, characteristics handed down through generations, through family trees to today. We look at a small grandchild and we see in them their grandparent. We talk about how they have their father's smile, their mother's eyes, their grandmother's temperament. And we name it as such. The first chapter of Matthew that Jim read for us a section from this morning, before we even get to the Christmas story. The Christmas story in Matthew is in the second chapter. The first chapter is the genealogy of Jesus' birth. We learn where Jesus comes from, not geographically, but genealogically. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. And Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and so on, generations upon generations, from Abraham to David, from David to the deportation to Babylon, from Babylon to the Messiah. What makes Jesus who he is? This is one of those scriptures a lot of times we skip over. We were talking this morning in our Sunday school class about how oftentimes we read scriptures at face value. They only go ink deep. Is the furthest we look into them. And this is one of those. We don't like reading about the genealogies. There's not a lot of sermons based on the book of Chronicles right? We don't dig into that because it's dull and it's boring and it's a long list of who begat who begat who begat who. And oftentimes we glaze over it and we don't notice what is being said to us in those words. But Matthew chose to start out the Gospel of Matthew with the genealogy of Jesus, where Jesus came from, his family, his ancestors. What made him who he is today? Jesus' ancestral list, who he comes from, who came before him. And as we look over the list, in our section this morning, we're given the names of a pair of twins. Judah, it says, is the father of Perez and Zerah by his wife, Tamar. Perez and Zerah. Now, these are not the only twins we encounter in the book of Genesis. The other twins get most of the headlines. Jacob and Esau, right? We've read scripture about Jacob and Esau. How Esau had the birthright. He was the firstborn, but he was a big, hairy oaf. Right? Jacob was the smarter one. Jacob was the one who wanted the birthright. So one day Esau's out in the field and he comes in, he's starving. He's been out all day working. And he comes in and Jacob has made a delightful little beef and barley stew. He's cooking it and Esau's famished. And he goes, "Give me some food." And Jacob says, "I'll give you a bowl of soup if you'll give me your birthright." And Esau does it. He hands over his birthright. He allows Jacob to be the one who will receive the inheritance. And it's Jacob that falls into the line of David, into the line of Jesus. That's the twins we usually hear about. But this is about Perez and Zerah. Perez and Zerah come to us from the 38th chapter of Genesis. And they don't appear much. There's not a page for them in children's Bibles. They don't get listed in a lot of sermons. Yet in many ways, the story of Perez and Zerah summarizes the biblical story more crisply than any other siblings in Scripture. The twins are born to Judah and Tamar, the product of an incestuous relationship between a father and his daughter-in-law, whom he thinks is a prostitute. Also a story not found in many children's Bibles. Just throw that out there. Judah will become the tribe of kings. This is the line of David through Judah. So it matters greatly which twin is going to get the inheritance. So when the twins are being born, one of them sticks his arm out first. And immediately, they tie a red piece of thread around his wrist so they'll know that he was the one coming out first. But then he pulls his arm back. And his brother barges past him and is actually born first. He is named Perez, which means breach or breakthrough. Following him, red string on his wrist, is his brother Zerah, which means the dawn. In these two names is found the heart of the gospel. Our world often looks for a Zerah. We want a king who rises up and shines like the dawn. We want the firstborn with the mark of royalty on his wrist. The Jews of 2,000 years ago wanted a triumphant king riding in front of a liberating army to restore Israel to earthly power and glory. People want the bright and shining leader. Zerah claims the birthright with his arm, but God chooses Perez, the brash boy of the breach, the child of breakthrough. He wants the sort of king we wouldn't pick. The younger, the weaker boy, without the obvious signs of kingship, who only triumphs because God breaks through on his behalf. The king born to a carpenter and his wife, witnessed by lowly shepherds, wrapped in bands of cloth. This is the plot line of the gospel. It's the plot line in Genesis. Again and again, the rising that looks impressive loses out to the breakthrough that doesn't. Human power rises up like the Tower of Babel and comes to nothing. Meanwhile, God makes a breach using an elderly couple in a tent in the desert. Older brothers throughout Genesis fail. Cain and Ishmael and Esau and Reuben. While younger brothers like Seth and Isaac and Jacob and Judah receive an inheritance. Natural fertility leads to nowhere. Meanwhile, the promises we see in Genesis come through the women who wait for a breakthrough. Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel. Even Tamar herself. The life of King David, likewise, is a Perez versus Zerah story. In David's story, there are Zerahs everywhere. The seven older brothers of Jesse, who look impressive. King Saul, who rises head and shoulders above everyone else. The giant Goliath, who rises 9 feet tall and appears to hold victory in his fist. But they are all overcome by the last-born, harp-playing, stone-throwing shepherd boy as he trusts the God of Perez to break through him. David remembers this lesson later when he ascends to the throne. In 2 Samuel, the 5th chapter, he defeats the Philistines and he names the battle site Baal Perez. He says there, as waters break out, the Lord has broken out against my enemies. In the next chapter, one of his men touches the Ark of the Covenant and drops dead. The fear of God falls on David, who names the place Perez Uzzah, because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. All of this helps to explain why Matthew's genealogy of Jesus only names one person who is not an ancestor, and that is Zerah. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah, Judah the father of Perez, and Perez the father of, the scripture goes on. But Zerah is listed here with Perez. Why name Zerah? He's not a direct ancestor. He's a brother of someone in the line of David. So why mention the brothers together? Family trees don't usually work this way. After all, there is no Ishmael mentioned in the genealogy, no Esau, no Reuben, no Levi. But Matthew feels compelled to record that Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah. Why mention this at all? Why bring the whole family into this moment? Maybe because the author of Matthew was reminding his readers of the story of Perez and Zerah. By mentioning them both and their father and mother, the listeners recall the story of Perez breaking out before his brother, busting past to claim his place, breaking out of the ordinary to the extraordinary moment. Maybe he mentions this because Jesus is breaking out as well. Jesus is not the ordinary king, born to a poor peasant girl, the son of a carpenter, laid in a manger, not a throne room. Jesus is a Perez, not a Zerah. He is not doing it like you're supposed to do it. He is changing the rules, going against the grain, breaking through into history to save us all. Jesus is a Perez. Jesus does not have the obvious sign of royalty around his wrist. He does not rise taller than everyone else. He wasn't even conceived through normal, natural conception, but through the Lord who bursts forth, who breaks through in God's own way, the God whose kingdom is where the last are first and the first are last. And that Jesus just set his face to go to Jerusalem. This is the start of Lent. We actually began 4 days ago on Ash Wednesday. Between last Wednesday and the Saturday before Easter, there are 40 days, not counting Sundays. This is the journey we take. And in the scripture, this is where Jesus began this journey. In Luke 9, when it says Jesus, as he was about to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. It means he turned his attention, his focus to this. This is what mattered now. This is where he was going now. There were other distractions along the way as they were going. Some towns didn't want to receive them because it was obvious Jesus wasn't staying. He had his face set towards Jerusalem. And so the towns didn't want to take him in. The disciples got mad and said, hey, you know, in Christian love, do you want us to burn this town to the ground? And Jesus said, no. No, stay focused. We're going to Jerusalem now. He had set his face to Jerusalem. This is the start of Lent. This is where we're going. We know we're going down this path to Easter. We're going down this path to the cross. We're going down this path to the resurrection. Purposely moving toward the point of all this. God breaking through our sin and our rebellion, breaking through our denial and our hurt, breaking through our lostness and our pain, to bring us true grace and love and forgiveness and righteousness. And you would think for that to happen, we're going to need a powerful, majestic king riding a white horse, leading an army, born to royalty, risen in power, gifted with lineage. But no. No, because I can't relate to that. I don't know what that is. I'm just a small town kid from a farm community in the back roads of Iowa, and I can't relate to the white knight, the conquering hero. I lug a trainload of disappointments and failures, sins and mistakes behind me, and the majestic conquering hero king wouldn't notice me. But the dirty little carpenter's son from backwater Nazareth, yeah, that guy I get. That's the king I need. The king that has walked in my steps, felt my pain. That king that sees me, that feels me, that I can follow. I need the king who breaks through, who breaches into my life, who changes me from who I am to whose I am. The one who takes away my burden because he has felt my burden. That is the king that brings my new dawn, my new life, my new hope. That is the king that calls me to Easter, not as conquering hero, but as sacrificed servant. That is the king that sets me free. Ultimately, in one of the beautiful ironies that only a sovereign God could orchestrate, Jesus is worshipped around the world for his rising, for bringing about the dawn of the new world. But even his Zerah is a Perez. His rising is a breakthrough, a breach in the walls of death and hell, a bursting forth of the Lord against his enemy. All power and glory to Jesus, descendant of Perez, the breakthrough, the breach. That's my coming.